Headlines, Russia says the U.S. is creating global chaos by not honoring its security commitments a day after announcing the suspension of a major nuclear treaty. Iran slaps sanctions on nearly 40 European Union and British entities and individuals in response to bans imposed on Iranian individuals and entities. The daughter of a slain black American civil rights activist, Malcolm X, announces a plan to sue the FBI and the CIA for his assassination back in 1965. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour. The chairman of Russia's State Duma has accused the United States of creating global chaos by not honoring commitments on security issues.
By ceasing to comply with its obligations and rejecting our country's proposals on global security issues, the United States destroyed the architecture of international stability. They plunged the world into a state of conflicts and challenges.
Volodin made the remarks as Duma is set to consider President Vladimir Putin's draft law on suspending the New START treaty with the U.S. The agreement is the last major pact between the two countries, which limits them on the deployed strategic nuclear arsenals. Russia and the U.S. possess nearly 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. Putin proposed the suspension of the treaty during Tuesday's annual State of the Nation address, arguing Moscow had been forced to take such a step. That's because, he said, the West wants to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia and claim its nuclear facilities. And Russia has alleged the U.S. was behind the explosions on the undersea Nord Stream gas pipelines last year, calling the attacks an act of international terrorism.
As many of us recall, in principle it was clear who could be behind this act of international terrorism. The U.S. made several statements and boiled down to the fact that if Russia continues to act in a way that is not pleasing to the U.S., then Nord Stream would be destroyed. Then there was the former foreign minister of Poland, Mr. Sikorski, who in his Russophobia thanked the U.S. on social media. Then there was the careless text sent to someone who also hates our country, the former Prime Minister of the U.K., Theresa May.
The Russian ambassador to the U.N. Made the remarks during a Security Council meeting called to discuss the gas pipeline blast. Nabenzi also accused Germany, Denmark, and Sweden of trying to cover up the U.S.'s role. The three countries launched an investigation shortly after the blast happened in September last year. They've so far concluded that the damage was caused by powerful explosions due to sabotage. Moscow has been pressing for an international probe after a U.S. investigative journalist alleged Washington was behind the incidents. Meanwhile, the U.S. has rejected Russia's claims, saying that Moscow is trying to distract the world from the war in Ukraine.
Let's be clear why we are really here in the Council today. Later this week, as we near the one-year anniversary, the General Assembly will debate the impact of Russia's illegal and full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Today's meeting is a blatant attempt to distract from this. As the world unites this week to call for a just and secure peace in Ukraine, consistent with the UN Charter, Russia desperately wants to change the subject.
The UK made similar comments asking why Russia has decided to bring up the incident after 5 months. The blast heavily damaged the multi-billion dollar pipelines that carried Russian gas to Germany. The explosions also invoked fears among climate activists as they sent huge volumes of methane, a potent greenhouse gas, into the atmosphere. China has said it is gravely concerned about the situation and asked for a thorough investigation into the incident. Ukraine's president says his country's forces are maintaining their positions on the front line in the east as Russia claims advances in that region.
It's very important that despite great pressure on our forces, the front line has undergone no change. I thank all our fighters for this, all soldiers and sergeants, officers and generals who are defending on the relevant front theaters.
Zelensky said Ukrainian forces in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk are doing everything to contain Russian attacks. Meanwhile, in Moscow, Russia's defense ministry said its forces were advancing on Bakhmut and Donetsk. Last week, Zelensky acknowledged in an interview that there may come a time when mounting losses might make it impractical to keep defending the city. NATO and the European Union accused Russia of escalating tensions over Ukraine after Moscow suspended participation in the New START arms control treaty. This is while Moscow insists that the West is to blame for the Ukraine conflict. Jerome Hughes reports in Brussels.
Senior NATO, EU and Ukrainian officials met in Brussels on Tuesday to discuss the war in Ukraine. The decision by Russia to step back from a 2010 nuclear arms control deal, the New START treaty, was criticised.
More nuclear weapons and less arms control makes the world more dangerous.
Regarding the treaty, some analysts claim it is the West that has been acting as the provocateur. After all, for weeks we have seen growing support amongst Russia's enemies for a large number of long-range missiles to be sent into Ukraine. NATO and the EU have agreed to help Ukraine establish its own weapons procurement system.
The production of warfare material in Europe today, it is still not in accordance with the urgency in the front line.
The US and its allies have provided Ukraine with at least 150 billion euro worth of arms in the past year. There is a growing anti-war sentiment in the EU.
Mostly good for the weapon industry, I guess. So it's almost wars always about making finances and stuff.
We all want peace. It's a crazy situation.
Of course, the prices, the rise of prices, yes, it's very worrying, yes.
I hope like the war is going to be like stopped as soon as possible.
There are regular calls in the European Parliament for peace talks.
12 months later, there is a risk this could become a permanent frozen conflict, not good for Ukrainian civilians or our citizens and businesses, dealing with price hikes and higher bills.
Perhaps there was a certain degree of arrogance on display at the gathering in NATO on Tuesday.
Although this is the first meeting that we held in this format, I already begin to regret that it will cease to exist when Ukraine will become members of both NATO and the EU.
For a whole host of reasons, experts say the chances of that happening anytime soon are slim to none. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In Greece, anti-war protesters and activists have held a rally in the capital, Athens, to denounce U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to the country.
Because they are an imperialist country that puts their nose everywhere, like they interfere all across the globe and do imperialism because they're imperialists, and we're against imperialism. And both here in Greece, in Ukraine, in the Middle East, everywhere where imperialism happens, and we want to fight against imperialism.
The protesters, with banners and signs displaying anti-NATO slogans, gathered outside the U.S. embassy. They accused Washington of meddling in Greece's affairs and pushing the country to get involved in the Ukraine conflict. They called on their government to avoid being part of the war and demanded the closure of foreign military bases in Greece. Blinken arrived in Athens on Monday. He held talks with senior Greek officials, including Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis and Foreign Minister Nikos Dendias, on issues like security and energy. Thousands of ambulance drivers across England and Wales have walked out yet again in an ongoing dispute with the government over pay, and staffing workers across industries in the UK have hit the picket lines in recent months to demand action from the government. Saipudo's report from London.
They said they were in it for the long haul, and they have kept their promise. Thousands of ambulance drivers from two separate unions walking off the job across much of England and Wales. Their demand, a pay award that keeps pace with the rising cost of living. The message, that the service is already stretched beyond its limit. Mondays are typically the busiest day for ambulance services across the country, with people now advised to use the 991 service only in an emergency. Despite the disruption, public support for the strikers is strong.
I live with two ambulance drivers and a nurse, so my answer is yes, they deserve more. I think they need more pay, yes.
We're very lucky the people that are working in the hospitals are nice enough to carry on working during the pandemic and not strike earlier, to be fair, because we needed them, they were there when we needed them, and when they need us, we're not there for them, sort of thing. So I think it's a shame.
Despite being on strikes, the crew still leave the picket lines to respond to emergency calls. But the message is, even serious calls will face substantial delays.
The strike action by NHS staff has only intensified in recent weeks, with multiple other walkouts planned for next month. Another single biggest day of action will be the beginning of March, when nurses will once again walk off the job, just like ambulance drivers are doing today.
The unions insist the solution is in the government's hands, a pay increase of about 10%. In the case of nurses, 5% above inflation that's stubbornly in the double digits. Yet the man holding the strings to the public purse, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, says that's not affordable.
Government spend lots of money on other things, even NHS-wise, that needn't be spent, that could be paying the people that look after everybody, yeah.
February has already seen more than 500,000 people take industrial action. With public strike fatigue nowhere in sight, the walkouts are likely to continue for months. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran has summoned the British charge d'affaires to protest what it called unfounded accusations leveled against Tehran. The foreign ministry told the UK envoy that the accusations are part of an Iranophobia policy, urging London to stop the unfriendly approach. The UK government has accused Iran of posing threat to journalists on British soil and summoned the Iranian envoy on Monday. Britain and the EU have also imposed several rounds of sanctions against Iran over what they call a crackdown on protests in recent months. They announced the latest such measures this week. On Tuesday, Tehran hit back, targeting dozens of UK and EU individuals and entities with sanctions. Iran says the EU and Britain back terror groups working against its security. Well, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has arrived at the Iraqi capital Baghdad on an official visit. Upon his arrival, Amir Abdollahian explained the aim of his trip to the Arab country.
This trip is aimed at pursuing bilateral issues and ties. Also, there will be meetings with senior Iraqi officials in which the two sides will discuss important regional and international issues.
Amir Abdollahian said his two-day visit to the neighboring country is at the invitation of his Iraqi counterpart Fuad Hussein. The top diplomat said Iraq plays a prominent role in the region and has returned to its normal position. He added his visit coincided a conference of the Arab Interparliamentary Union in Baghdad. The visiting Iranian minister was welcomed by a number of senior Iraqi officials, including Deputy Foreign Minister Hisham Al-Alawi. The Central Bank of Iran, CBI, has opened a new gold and currency exchange center in a bid to regulate market fluctuations, stabilize market rates, and control speculative trade. Gisumi Shamari has more details on that.
Bringing currency volatility under control is the name of the game for the new governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, who is charged with getting a grip on the Iranian rial and devising new strategies to alleviate the country's economic woes amid unprecedented Western sanctions. And to do so, he has unveiled a new golden currency exchange center in an effort to regulate market fluctuations, or in his own words, stabilize market rates by adjusting demand and supply. But most importantly, as a powerful tool to control speculative inflation. For those familiar with Iran's economy, the most essential economic parameter that can effectively tip the scales.
We have enough resources to provide for all demands for exchange. The main challenge we are facing is speculative inflation as a consequence of negative forecasts, which leads to producers increasing the price of commodities and therefore creates a vicious circle. We need to overcome this challenge, and I'm calling on all those involved in economic activities to join hands with us and strictly follow the new policies of this newly launched center of exchange.
This means that all foreign exchange resources, notably from export, must be supervised by the central bank.
The 28,500 toman exchange rate for basic commodities and essential medicines still stands. Other demands for foreign currencies have been carefully categorized, and in the first leg, we are allocating $4 million to specific purposes, which include travel, studying abroad, and research projects, the details of which will be announced shortly.
This is actually a policy that has been successfully implemented by Russia and allowed the ruble to recover its value within a month after its initial plunge at the beginning of the Ukraine war.
Russia's success in implementing this policy is mostly due to their system of financial supervision, which ensures that regulatory rules are strictly observed. There are major differences between the economic and monetary structures and approaches of Iran and Russia. And if Iran wants to succeed, it has to take all this into account.
And the good news is, if this policy is successfully implemented, the recovery of the rial is imminent in a situation very similar to what happened in Russia. Russia's national currency is gaining strength. The ruble is hitting new highs against the U.S. dollar. The Russian economy is making a turnaround despite unprecedented Western sanctions and pressure. Now Iran, taking Russia as a role model, is hoping to do the same. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
And Malcolm X was the iconic leader of African-American Muslims and a civil rights activist who was assassinated 58 years ago. Now his daughter, she intends to sue the FBI, the CIA, New York City Police, and others for his death.
For years, our family has fought for the truth to come to light concerning his murder. And we'd like our father to receive the justice that he deserves. The truth about the circumstances leading to the death of our father is important not only to his family, but to many followers, many admirers, many who look to him for guidance, for love. And it is our hope that litigation of this case will finally provide some unanswered questions. We want justice served for our father. Thank you.
Shabazz accused various federal and New York government agencies of fraudulently concealing evidence. She claimed the evidence shows the agencies conspired to assassinate Malcolm X. Shabazz says she seeks $100 million in damages. Malcolm X was killed on stage while preparing to deliver a speech. Soon after, some of his associates said they believed various government agencies were aware of the assassination plot and let it happen. In 2021, a New York State judge threw out the convictions of two men who mistakenly spent decades in prison for the murder. The judge said there had been a miscarriage of justice. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Leaders meeting with commanders and officers of the Iranian Air Force. On Wednesday, 8th of February 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of commanders and officers of the Iranian Air Force at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in Tehran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Every year, on 8th of February, we're reminded of an important historic event. On 8th of February 1979, in the final dying days of the moribund Pahlavi regime, a group of top commanders and officers of the Iranian Air Force pledged their allegiance to the founding father of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. This important event was the final nail in the coffin of the hated Pahlavi regime and a key to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This historic event was a milestone in the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and every year, on 8th of February, the leader meets with personnel and officers of the Iranian Air Force to commemorate this event, and this year, of course, was no exception. Ayatollah Khamenei welcomed the audience and emphasized that 8th of February meeting is a meeting close to his heart. He said, "This meeting is sweet both for you, remembering that important historic event, and for me, it is even sweeter, since I witnessed that event from close up and have followed the development of the Air Force and the Army up until today." Ayatollah Khamenei further added, "Events are usually indicative of certain truths. Various events should be looked at this way, both natural disasters and human tragedies. Every event that takes place has a message and shows us a truth. This event is no different. The event that took place on 8th of February 1979 also points to some truths. The most important of these truths was that it showed a glimpse of the structure, composition, and the truth of the new army that was being formed in the new governing system. The 8th of February 1979 gave us a glimpse of the army of the future, the army of the Islamic Revolution. What is its essence and what is its structure? That day showed us all of these things." Further remarks, the leader added, "It also showed us that the new army was an army of the people. It was from the people. Air Force personnel went to a place where thousands of people went every day to pledge their allegiance to Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. They showed their revolutionary credentials because they stood before the leader of the revolution, saluted him, and declared their allegiance and obedience. They showed they were believers. The signs of belief in spirituality and belief in Islam were clearly evident in that group of Air Force personnel. This was a pointer to the fact that the army of the future would be a faithful army. It also showed that it was an army dedicated to order. On 8th of February 1979, it was uncertain how the revolution would play out. The fate of the Islamic Revolution was uncertain. At that time, martial law had been declared. That is, it was not clear what the outcome would be. It was certainly possible that events would drag out for another month or two. In that case, the Air Force personnel would have been dealt with harshly. They didn't know what was going to happen, but they took risks. They showed courage, and they came forward. This showed that the army of the future was willing to take risks. And to be fair, the Islamic Republic army has in fact taken risks in the years that have followed. They showed that the army was a clenched fist confronting the aggressor. Of course, the aggressors of that day were the American agents and the agents of the Pahlavi regime. But later, other aggressors emerged too. But the army stood up staunchly to all of them. Commenting further, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "The event of 8th of February 1979 raised people's spirits and they felt the army was not against them anymore. Now the army was on their side, on the side of the people, and on the side of the Islamic Revolution, and this raised people's spirits." Thinking back about the images of that day, the picture that was published in the newspapers, and so on. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was sitting there. He was the embodiment of power, the embodiment of dignity, and the embodiment of unshakable faith. This great, dignified, authoritative figure was looking at these young men of the Air Force with a kind, paternal look. That day, they were still part of the Pahlavi army, but the Imam looked at these young men with a paternal and a kind look, accompanied by complete affection and complete trust. Emphasizing the importance of remaining a revolutionary, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "Some are revolutionary, but they don't remain revolutionary. They become revolutionary, but they do not remain revolutionary. The army remained revolutionary throughout all of these years. Let me tell you this, I was in the army from the first day of the revolution. I would visit different parts of the army, and I was in contact with everyone. Today, our army, the army of the Islamic Republic, is much more revolutionary than in those early days of the Islamic Revolution." Turning to the 11th of February rallies and marches marking the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, the leader said, "It will be 11th of February in 2 or 3 days' time. The 11th of February, 22nd of Bahman, is the peak of the Iranian nation's movement and pride. 11th of February this year, like in previous years, is a reminder of the most glorious day in the known history of the Iranian nation. That is, there is no prouder day for the Iranian nation than 11th of February, 22nd of Bahman, as far as we now know in our long history. Of course, we have had proud days, but none have been like 11th of February in terms of greatness. When the Iranian nation was able to regain its dignity, with its own strength, with its own ability, and with its own determination. The 11th of February, in the following years, are all reminders of that day. The 11th of February this year, God willing and with God's grace, will be a demonstration of people's presence, a demonstration of people's dignity, and a demonstration of people's trust in each other and in their government. It will be a demonstration of national unity. My recommendation is that all our dear people try to make this march, this great day, 11th of February, and this glorious movement a demonstration of national unity and national solidarity. Send this clear message to the enemy that their efforts aimed at eliminating national unity have all failed, and they cannot separate people from each other, and they cannot cause a gap, a chasm between the government and the people. They cannot separate the people from the government. They cannot make the government pessimistic about the people. They cannot push different groups of people to fight each other. Political differences, differences of opinion, are natural differences and are not a problem in society. However, these differences mustn't lead to fights, to slander, to accusations and the like. This is the strategy that we must take in confronting the strategy of the enemy. If we strive and are resolved, the Almighty God will help us. God willing, inshallah. Turning to the devastating earthquakes in Syria and in Turkey, the leader said, "We feel great sorrow for our disaster-stricken brothers in the two countries of Syria and Turkey, and we ask Almighty God to bestow His mercy on the deceased and grant patience to those who have survived. We ourselves, of course, have been afflicted by earthquakes before. We know when an earthquake strikes and families lose their loved ones how hard it is and how bitter it is. We feel their pain and ask the Almighty God for patience and calm for them." In final remarks, the leader said, May Almighty God bless the pure soul of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul, who brought us onto this path and guided us.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Russia has suspended its participation in the New START treaty with the United States on Tuesday. The treaty limits the two sides' nuclear arsenals, which accounts for 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow is not withdrawing from the treaty, but need to evaluate NATO's overall goals. Given the current conflict in Ukraine, he said it would be absurd under the current conditions to allow the U.S. to inspect its military facilities, which is part of the New START treaty. What does this all mean for Russia, for the U.S., for NATO, and the world? Stay with us as we take a look at this on The Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guest now to the program. Christoph Horstel, author and politician out of Berlin. And John Busnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us on The Spotlight. I'd like to start this off with Christoph. What is your overall take on the announcement by President Putin about suspending Russia's participation in the New START treaty?
Three items are there on the table, very obviously. This is a last warning towards the West and all Western countries that if they pursue the present course, a nuclear war cannot be excluded. That is a very clear story. There's a more than 20-year-old Russian doctrine on this situation, meaning if the much higher armed NATO will push Russia to the wall, Russia may use nuclear arms as a last consequence first. And that is a huge danger because the U.S. have openly declared they want to press Russia to the wall. They want to make Russia a victim, losing the war and things like that. And that means we are headed for nuclear war, number one. Then comes number two, that obviously Putin is using the same rationale the West has used for the intermediate forces treaty. They stopped from Washington's side. because Russia quotes Great Britain and France as nuclear powers and says we cannot do start and just, you know, be negligent for this threat from Great Britain and France as nuclear powers. They have to be included into the treaty somehow, and that means they have to renegotiate with the U.S. And the last point is the U.S., and I mean Iran knows this firsthand very well, is keeping treaties only if they are just happy to do so. If they are not, they will stop keeping up their words with treaties. And that means Russia has to be very, very careful what kind of treaty they want to honor in the future, because Washington does not if they feel so.
John, your take. I mean, Russia said actually that it was actually the United States who violated the treaty already, or treaty first. What's your opinion about that? What exactly do you think they mean?
Well, there's no doubt that the United States is operating in bad faith on all of these topics, and that the United States is attempting to provoke an armed conflict. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. So I would say that a fair and neutral party would support President Putin's very clear, very legal, and very correct warning to the West that it's time to stop. Because everything that Ukraine is doing with the puppet president in Kiev is being directly ordered and commanded by the U.S. government. Nothing more.
Why do you think he chose this time, John, to make this announcement?
Well, I think that we are on the beginning edge of Russia's main military, special military operation offensive to protect the ethnic Russians of Ukraine and to terminate the threat to the heartland of Russia from Ukrainian missiles and Ukrainian other weapons of mass destruction. Therefore, as this operation begins and starts to take the form of a complete destruction of the Zelensky regime, that would be the most likely time to see NATO directly intervene. If NATO directly intervenes in this region, Russia has the right to use every available means, and that includes nuclear weapons. Nobody should have any confusion about the situation.
What about that, Christoph? You heard what John said. Because we also saw earlier today Joe Biden, U.S. President Joe Biden, in Warsaw. It was almost like a pep rally, and basically talking about that they have no choice but to continue, but to go ahead and fight for freedom. I mean, are we just headed for an outright on head-on collision between the U.S. and Russia?
Exactly. And it's Washington that drives this very much. Russia has warned for 7 months before they had to take steps, because Kiev, by Zelensky, on February 19 last year, threatened they would not, you know, honor the Budapest Accord anymore, which means Ukraine could start developing their own nuclear weapons. And that was the key starting point, according to the Russian sources, very clearly so. And of course, we are in a very dangerous situation, because this is Europe. Washington is very far away. They love to watch us go down, as they are so sweetly happy that Ukraine is going down right now.
Okay. Well, John, you know, the treaty actually provides for 18 on-site inspections per year for U.S.-Russian inspection teams. And what does it mean now when we talk about, because President Putin said he's not talking about totally leaving it, but it's suspended. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I guess the best way to describe this is that the primary function at this time of any U.S. inspections of Russian nuclear facilities would be for the purposes of targeting those facilities. And I give you the analogy here. During the NATO war in Kosovo, prior to initiating the war and attacking Serbia to seize Kosovo, the United States infiltrated the inspection services of the UN and the UN force in Kosovo for the specific purposes of locating the targeting for aerial bombardment and rocket attacks. So this is not some speculation. This is a proven fact with a clear precedent in the very recent past.
Well, Christoph, Russia has said that though it's suspending its the New START treaty, it will still abide by the qualitative limitations of the treaty. Your analysis of this, and does that sound like a power which is actually seeking to expand the conflict, or tell me your take on this?
No, of course, Russia has never tried, not in one single step, to expand any conflict. They are not trying to expand their territory. They're not trying to, you know, run over Ukraine, Poland, and then enter Germany as Washington accuses them to do. No, this is typically NATO style. And again, as always, Washington and NATO accuse somebody else of exactly those feats which they do themselves. So this is the adverse order of things which we are looking into here. We know that Germany, on behalf of Washington, is violating the Non-Proliferation Act, nuclear non-proliferation, that is, because we share, you know, nuclear weapons on our territory in Büchel in western Germany, and we fly bombers capable of carrying nuclear bombs. And this is forbidden according to this pact. And of course, we are doing it. And now, later, dozens of years later than NATO, Russia has started the same kind of undertaking with Belarus, with White Russia. And that is interesting that Putin, when that started, said, this was not our idea. Somebody else did it first. And that is what we see here. Always, you know, Russian takes the second step after, sometimes even very long after, Washington has started the first. That's what we are seeing here again. And that's a caution clause that Putin declared here, that he says, well, look what you can lose if you continue, Washington, your belligerent course. And again, I'm quite sure, as in the last 1.5 years, Washington will try its level best to push NATO not to listen to Moscow, not to listen to the warnings, because that would stop the belligerent cause and path of Washington, and Washington wants war in Europe. That's the best point.
Well, John, I mean, Christoph, sorry, let me interrupt you there, because you said Washington wants to push NATO further in this. I mean, you're sitting in Germany. It's a so-called sovereign nation anyway. I mean, do the Europeans not get what is going on, that actually they're the ones that are going to lose big time, much bigger probably than the Americans? I mean, your take on that side of it.
Okay, it's very clear that we are made to lose here. I said in the past, Germany is the guaranteed loser of the next war against Russia. And be careful about this. We signed the 2+4 treaty. Yeah? We had the NATO-Russia Act, and we violated both of them very thoroughly. Russia would have the legal right to invade Germany on a very short telephone, red telephone notice to Washington, Paris, and London, saying, look, guys, we are coming. That's self-defense. That's allowed. So this is the situation here. Russia is not coming because they are not aggressive. The aggression sits solely and exclusively with Washington, and the Europeans know it, but they are so corrupt, they are more afraid of their Washingtonian leaders than of their own voters and populations. That's the dirty fact here.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Wow, absolutely amazing. Well, John, I mean, why do you think that NATO, led by the United States, has been so aggressive in approaching Russian borders, even prior to the war with Ukraine, while knowing that Moscow has a powerful nuclear arsenal?
Well, let me begin by saying I support and agree with every word of your other guest here today. The best way to get a grip on this situation is not to view NATO as a defensive alliance. NATO is, like the rest of the American structures, a money-making business. The purpose of NATO is to consistently and without any interruption drive the American economy by forcing the upgrading and expansion of military production by the military-industrial complex, which is the profit-making element of America. If there is no war anywhere, and if the military-industrial complex is not generating profits, there will be mass unemployment in the United States, economic collapse, and there will be a public question as to what is the purpose of our military alliance that costs us trillions of dollars to maintain. Those are the questions that America is trying to avoid. And we have to remember that Joseph Biden is a man who has never had a military uniform on his back. He has zero military experience. For him, this is a money issue and nothing more. They need to make money, and they only make it by killing people around the world.
Well, John, what you're saying, okay, but again, I have to come back in with the European factor. You're talking about the military-industrial complex. You're talking about keeping the American war machine running. And what about the Europeans in the middle of this? I mean, they are the ones. Are they also profiting, or are they willing, these leaders, to sacrifice their people to that extent? As our guest in Berlin said, Christoph said, it's because of the way, how much they fear Washington. Do you agree? Is it the fear factor or something else with the Europeans to go along with this?
It's a combination. The politicians in most of the leading Western European states are people who have been elected at the behest of Washington. The United States has an intelligence service that is in every NATO country. They select the candidates, they organize the financing of the candidates, and they blackmail the candidates with the spying information that they developed about them over their entire lifetimes. These are puppet rulers. There have not been any independent leaders in Western Europe since Charles de Gaulle. That was the last time a European leader said anything to NATO to the degree that we are not going to do what you order us to do. So we've got a cohort of vassal leaders whose primary reason for being in power is to serve their master. Their master is not their domestic population. Their master is Washington. And in fact, they fear their domestic population because they have no legitimacy, but they fear Washington more because the party that put them into power could take them out of power far faster than the people.
Hmm. Well, Christoph, with what John has just said, is there any hope that the people of Europe can actually rise up and be able to change the status quo? Or your assessment of that side?
Yeah. I totally agree with John here. Our top candidates, as in all of the NATO countries, are chosen by their blackmailability. If they have committed anything in their former life before taking high office, which makes them a very, you know, happy victim of Washington's blackmail, they are chosen to make the big career. This is the way it works here. And we know this for the German chancellor, and we know this on many sides. We know this by the careers. So what's the opposition hope here? It's next to zero. In Germany, the opposition is completely subverted by CIA and by the forces and the Atlantic Bridge and all these, you know, bodies we have here in Germany, which are part of Washington's colonial system. So the opposition right now in Germany is unable to ask, to answer the question, what are your five top demands? I'm trying to push this into Germany since months. It is very hard. The other side has the money. The other side has the power. The other side has the surveillance system. That means the CIA knows exactly who is doing what, who is thinking what in the German opposition. And then they send their agents. And I'm seeing all these bloody CIA agents flood through the German opposition. And you know what this reminds me of? Of the German resistance against Adolf Hitler. There was one man sitting in Switzerland. He was the head of the later CIA. He had contacts to all the anti-Hitler resistance groups. They trusted the Americans. And they did very wrong to do that, because from there it was stopped. They stopped so many actions against Hitler. America did that. They needed Germany completely on the ground. And this goal remains the same, and it is now valid for all of Europe. They want us on the ground. We are competence. We are some kind of competition to them. So they want us down. And they want us under the rule of Washington. So this is the tool they use, that they have, you know, and in fact subverted the whole opposition here. And that means that hope is very faint. I'm working my heart out for that. Many people do this with me, apart from me, but we are so weak. We must, you know, very openly confess that this is literally nearly impossible.
Well, John, how dangerous do you see this current situation? And do you see the war between Ukraine and Russia getting worse and deteriorating, and having the U.S. and Russia basically go direct on this?
Well, first of all, the situation is extremely dangerous, not just because there's a senile man in office in Washington, but because he is surrounded by the same kind of warmongers as advisors who led the neocons around the Republicans. For these people, the attack on Russia and the pressure on Russia is a resource hunt to steal the wealth of Russia, the world's largest country, and to pivot via Russia to destroy China. For these people, once again, it's a matter of money and resources. And the U.S. president is normally the man who is supposed to try and keep this under control. This is the opposite situation today. Joseph Biden is literally a puppet on a string of the military-industrial complex, which put him in power, because the military-industrial complex, after suffering public outcry during the Vietnam War, made their number one priority the buying up of the media. That means that all the news about this conflict, all of the opinions that might be against war, are being censored out of the media, and the American public is only hearing a single mantra. And the mantra is, Russia is evil, China is evil, we've got to destroy them. And even a sensible person, when subjected to 24/7 brainwashing, starts to wonder whether the message is true. And as soon as the American people get to the point where they believe the message that war is inevitable, we're going to see this thing really get serious. As for your other question about the war in Ukraine, I don't know how you would define the war in Ukraine as being worse or better, but Russia is winning the battle on the ground against the Ukrainian armed forces, hands down. It is a rout. And as a result of that, we're seeing crisis management in the Western European countries, which have put all their stakes behind their puppet, Zelensky.
And on that note, I appreciate you both being with me. Very interesting discussion. Out of Berlin, Christoph Horstel, author and politician. Out of Belgrade, John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Appreciate you being with me. And as always, a pleasure having you with us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Jawad was the son of the eighth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. Imam al-Jawad was one of the most wonderful pictures of intellect and knowledge in Islam, an individual who possessed the virtues and nobilities of the entire world, an individual who made springs of wisdom and knowledge flow upon the earth, and an individual who was the teacher and pioneer of the scientific and cultural revival of his age.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.